Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Frances Nesbitt and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Monday from 4 to 5. We hope you've recovered from yet another beating of the beast from the east. And you can get in touch with the show today. We'd love to hear from you. Send any questions or comments that you might have to us by text to 086 353 7782 or by phone on 776 2777, or you can email the show at any stage, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about chocolate with Mary Tien from the Truffle Fairy in Thomastown and Kilkenny. And we'll be chatting to John McKenna in a little while about McKenna's Guides and John and Sally's new book, Ireland the Best Of. And we'll talk about the cost of food, some gardening jobs to do this week, and we'll touch on a little bit of nature later on as well. Mags, how was your week?
Good. Another busy week.
A busy week. It started off with the Patrick's weekend.
Yes, which was bracingly cold in Thomastown and everywhere. But it could have been worse. We could have had like a couple of inches of snow like we did the day after. Mm. So I suppose dry and cold was as good as we could have expected at the time.
It was very, very cold though.
Mm.
Everything is a little kind of set further back, even in the garden and stuff.
Oh, I think the garden is just so far behind. Like, even the daffodils look like they're not actually going to bloom properly. Mm. I think I said that again last week, but they really do this week. But we had a great day in Thomastown. The parade, the Great Wheelbarrow Dash, was another great success.
Excellent.
There was all sorts turned out. Great turnout and stuff. But there was actually, it was afterwards that we realised there was one float, which was a handmade wheelbarrow, containing an actual snowman that a man had saved from the snow in his freezer and then brought it out for the day. And of course it didn't melt on the day because it was so cold, so it got carted around, and he had it done up with some Brennan's bread and a litre of milk, and he called it the child of Emma and the Beast.
Oh, wow.
That was very clever. So that was one of my favourite ones, actually.
There was a lot of thought went into that, if the man froze his own snowman.
Yeah,
in the freezer.
And it wasn't a tiny snowman, it was quite a substantial one. So, he's actually just lives down the road from me, but I thought it was quite clever and very entertaining.
And the rain held off in Kilkenny and out in Thomastown, I think.
Yeah, it did until later, so yeah. We were lucky with that. Lucky with that it was dry.
And then more snow the day after, on the 18th.
Yeah.
God almighty. And they're forecasting snow again for next weekend.
It's almost hard to believe this one, isn't it?
It really is now. It's just getting beyond a joke, really, at this stage. The spuds are still not in the ground out at Crowan. And normally they'd be in long before St. Patrick's Day. But there's just no point. The ground is so wet. I can't even get it ready to put the spuds in. They'll be chitted and growing in the potting shed before they ever get near the ground. You've a course coming up tomorrow?
Yeah, of course, tomorrow. So I actually had a very busy morning. I made actually probably a bumper cooking day this morning. Made soup, focaccia, a salad for tomorrow, chickpea salad, and two sourdough and chocolate brownies. So,
did you bring in any of your chocolate brownies?
I did, actually.
It's funny because I also have a course tomorrow, and one of the treats I've made are chocolate and beetroot brownies.
Is this a bake-off?
And I brought in some chocolate and beetroot brownies. Ooh. For you to try.
Well, I didn't put vegetables in my brownies. I brought in more, though, so I win on quantity, actually.
Okay,
anyway.
Well, yeah. We can maybe have a little taste of those coming up to the break and see how we get on.
We can compare.
Did you bring
recipes.
Your recipe in?
I did, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mine's not a secret or anything, is yours?
Oh, no, mine's published on the Crow and Cottages website, so I'm allowed to talk about it. Yep, and it has beetroot in it. The very last of the beetroots from the garden now, they're a bit kind of not great to look at, but once you do a bit of peeling, they're perfectly fine. And if you roast them or cook them, they're grand. But you wouldn't go jarring them up.
Well, I actually found some purple sprouting broccoli that I planted last year, and it's now.
Congratulations!
I know. I know quite a bit of it, actually.
It's perfect time for it. It is, yeah. It's a nice surprise when you find stuff like that.
Because the place looks shocking, but anyway, still a few bits and pieces growing.
So you'll have purple sprouting broccoli for dinner for the next few days?
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing about purple sprouting broccoli, and actually most of the broccolis and cauliflowers and stuff like that, they don't last very long. So the season is instant. You know, it's ready now.
Oh,
but you can't leave it in the ground and kind of say, right, I'll have that on Sunday or next Tuesday, because it'll go past its best.
Oh, okay.
Those little florets will open up into flowers.
Right, then, we might be having a lot tomorrow, so.
Yeah, well, you can make soup from it maybe as well.
Yeah. But yeah, I have a bread class in the morning and another one on Tuesday and one on Friday, so it's...
A busy week of classes.
Yeah, there's actually been a huge upsurge in interest in bread classes since the snow.
And do you think it has anything to do with the chat about, you know, bread shortages?
I think people kind of realise that, you know, maybe we could be able to make this ourselves and not rely on supermarkets, or maybe they did make some themselves while they were at home and now we just want to perfect it a little bit. So, but yeah.
And they realise now they're not going to, after your class, be able to make a large white sliced pan, do they?
I hope so.
Right.
Anyway,
a very different
find out
beast.
Tomorrow.
Okay,
it is quite a different beast, yeah.
And the classes you're doing then, are they sourdough bread or
sourdough and fresh yeast?
Okay.
So I just bought another kilo of fresh yeast, which would make a room full of bread probably, but we'll get through it in the next couple of days.
Now the fresh yeast is a little kind of easier to use than the sourdough starter, so it's not something that you have to keep alive and feed every day.
No, you can buy it in the shop and it has a shelf life and that's it. I think it's the best way to kind of start taking on sourdough first. You can kind of learn your skills with the fresh yeast, which is a little bit more predictable and easier to manage. So if you do your skills with the fresh yeast and then you can move on to sourdough, that's kind of what I always try to give to people, just to use fresh yeast first.
Probably a little more consistent as well, would it be?
Yeah, much more predictable.
Okay, so what would be involved then in making a loaf of bread with some of your fresh yeast?
Let's say you just want to make a regular traditional white slice pan. You'd need, to make three of them, you'd go for like 50 grams of fresh yeast, 870 grams of water, put your water and your yeast together. You want a kilo and a half of strong white flour, 30 grams of butter, and 30 grams of salt.
Okay.
So depending on whether you're using a mixer or you're doing it by hand, rub your butter into your flour, add your salt, and then pour your water and your yeast into the middle. Mix it all up in your bowl until it kind of comes together roughly. Put it out onto your worktop, and then you knead it. And kneading, depending on how good you are at it, really, to be honest, will take anything from 5 minutes to 10 minutes. Shouldn't take any longer than that. Some people are just have a natural ability to, you barely have to show them, and some people just need a little bit more help with it.
What exactly are you doing when you're kneading the dough?
Well, you're turning it from kind of a very loose mixture into a nice formed dough. So you're combining all of your ingredients and you're moving the glutens around, so the glutens are getting a chance to work, to be fed by all of what you have. So that's what you're doing really. And then when you've kneaded like that, you leave it just sitting in a bowl covered for an hour, and it'll double in size. And during that time you don't need to do anything to it. Just leave it sitting in a room temperature. It doesn't need to be in a hot press or any of that sort of crack.
Doubling in size then, so that's the yeast actually getting to work.
Yeah.
Eating some of the sugars.
Sugars from the flour.
Okay, and producing gas bubbles within the dough.
Yeah, bubbles, not really gassy, to be honest. The salt regulates the yeast, so you always need some salt. If you had no salt, it would just kind of bubble up all over the place, but the salt kind of keeps it in check. So you need your salt and your yeast quantities need to be perfect for it to work right. And then after the hour, then you, let's say, divide that big piece of dough into three, mould it into a little round, let it rest again for 10 minutes, and then you're going to shape it into your loaf, pop it into your tin, dust with flour, and leave it again for another 45 minutes. Score it and bake it in a hot oven.
And during that 45 minutes then, it's going to increase in size again?
It's going to increase again. So when you put it into your loaf tin, like, it'll be under the top of the tin, maybe 3/4 of the size of the tin, and then when it's risen, it'll be over the tin, and you'll see it'll have risen up nicely.
And when it goes into the oven then, there's no more rising happens. So the shape it goes into the oven, is that pretty much the shape?
No, there'll be another little bit of rising and stuff with the heat in that. So there'll be another little bit of rising and the crust will form. So you'll have, you know, if you think about a regular loaf-shaped tin, your dough will be nicely up over it in a nice kind of dome above the side of the tin.
Okay. Well, that sounds absolutely delicious.
Well, it is.
And do they get to take home, some of the people who do the course?
Yeah, they get to take home lots. Tomorrow we're going to do sourdough, some of those traditional loaves, some brioche buns, a focaccia, which they generally have for lunch, and then we do kind of sourdough at the beginning and sourdough at the end, just different parts of the process. So yeah, that takes 5 hours.
And the fresh yeast, where do you get your fresh yeast?
I buy it in Super Value at the baker's counter. I actually bought a kilo today. They only charged me €1 for it.
All right.
Or okay, you can buy it in the some of the Polish shops have it.
Okay, so that, and it, it keeps in the fridge, I presume.
Keeps in the fridge for a couple of weeks.
All right, okay. Well, that sounds a much easier way to kind of get introduced to the bread making than the sourdough.
Yeah, sourdough was kind of the king of breads, but fresh yeast bread, you make really nice bread, you know, very predictable, very consistent, and easy to kind of get a handle of if you're just starting out.
And still a living process with the yeast in there rather than a chemical process, which is, you know, with the baking soda
Yeah, and you have a much nicer flavour from fresh yeast, and you can smell the bread. It smells like proper yeasty bread. Much nicer flavour. You'll never go back, to be honest.
All right, very good. I've been doing a lot of baking myself this week, actually. Apart from the brownies, I also made some... I have a course on out at Crowan Cottages tomorrow, and it's a butchery course. So, as you'd imagine, the people who do a butchery course are big into their meats. And I like to give them some treats when they get there with a cup of coffee, and then some treats in the afternoon with another coffee, and then, of course, a dessert. And I've just remembered I need to make a crumble. I almost forgot that. But one of the cookies which went down really well the last time we had the butchery course was bacon and beer cookies.
Oh.
So baking with bacon, it's the future. I can highly recommend it. Yeah, if you want to fill your house, everybody loves the smell, or most people love the smell of baking, or bacon when it's cooking, unless you're a vegetarian or vegan maybe. But bake with bacon, and that's the house filled with beautiful baking smells as well as the smell of cooking bacon.
I've never tried anything like that, I have to say.
It's absolutely delicious. I candied the bacon, which involves laying out some Muscovado sugar on a little bit of parchment on a baking tray, and then laying some nice fatty streaky rashers on the sugar, and then sprinkling some more Muscovado sugar over them. And Muscovado sugar gives you that kind of, it's cane sugar, so it gives you that kind of smoky, kind of
molasses-y taste.
Kind of taste. Yeah. And I pop those into the oven for about 20 minutes, and the sugar kind of caramelizes and goes nice and dark and sticks to the bacon, and the bacon gets cooked. And what you end up with is a bacon, sticky, sweet mess, really. Which I then chop up into little pieces.
Did you have some of it at that stage?
I did. I couldn't resist it. It just smells so good.
Sounds nice.
And then I mix that into a beer cookie dough. So I make up a cookie dough out of some light brown sugar and some Demerara sugar, 150 grams of butter, a couple of eggs, and a little bit of vanilla extract, and then I add in some beer as the liquid. And then I'm going to say self-raising flour, which I know would probably upset you.
No, you could
probably use plain flour and a little bit of fresh yeast, but then you'd have to leave it alone for a while. But
would you put yeast in it?
No, I just use the self-raising flour.
Oh yeah,
and a little bit of salt, and I cream together the butter and the sugars, and beat in the eggs, add the vanilla and a little tiny bit of beer just to kind of loosen up the mix, and the flour and the salt, obviously, and then threw the bacon pieces. And I rolled that into a kind of sausage and stuck it in the fridge and let it go a bit hard. And then I was able to slice it up nice and easily and put the little discs out on, again, parchment paper on a baking tray.
Very good.
And into the oven for about 15 minutes.
They sound really nice.
They
sound really interesting, actually. Did you bring in some
of
those?
Actually, I brought in the offcuts. I cut them up nice and neat then for the table, because, you know, for the boards to present to people doing the course tomorrow. So some of the bits around the edges were a bit untidy, so I brought those in for you. So you can see it's a beautiful brown crumb.
It looks kind of like a gingerbread, actually.
It does look like a gingerbread, yeah. And you can smell a little bit of the beer in there. Not too sweet, a kind of savoury flavour to it. Mm. And then every now and again you get a nice chunk of that really chewy, sweet bacon, which I think is absolutely lovely.
You could actually have them with a beer.
You could have them with a beer. Mm. You're right, yeah. They're kind of savoury as well as sweet. Mm. So I might stick the recipe for those up. Actually, the recipe for those, as far as I remember, is on the Crowan Cottages website, crowancottages.com. So if you did a search for bacon and beer cookies. And there's actually a few different recipes out there, including one by our own Donal Skeen. And not a recipe I would have associated with Donal Skeen. But anyway, there you go.
Well, there's Scandinavian influence maybe or something.
There's a version of that on the Crowan Cottages website, crowancottages.com, and it's bacon and beer cookies, and I can highly recommend them.
So can I.
Good.
Very nice.
So that's what the butchers will be having tomorrow, and as part of that course then, we're going to be butchering up some pork, so we're going to do a pig, and I'll cook off some tasters while the lads are breaking down the pig into the primary cuts. And the whole idea of these courses is to give a little bit of skill to people to allow them to identify cuts that they wouldn't normally see in a supermarket. And a little bit of knowledge that maybe means that they can go to the butcher and use some of the lesser known cuts, save themselves a little bit of money, still have a delicious meal, and, you know, how to identify those cuts, how to use them. So we'll break down a pig and then we'll make up some sausage mixes from the off cuts. And the lads, everybody will get to make their own sausage, their own sausages. And then we'll have some lunch, a meaty feast. I'm going to do a haunch of venison in the wood oven and maybe some loin of pork as well. And then in the afternoon, we'll butcher some deer. So I've got two deer on the way from Wicklow. They were just shot yesterday. And they, we'll skin those and butcher them from start to finish.
Wow. Mm. And is the course is full, I think, is it?
The course is full, yeah. There's places on another one that we're running in October, but the one tomorrow is full. But yeah, it's amazing, as well as the bread. Like, the butchery course is really, really popular.
Yeah.
An awful lot of people want to kind of learn these forgotten skills, or skills that, you know, are... grandparents or great-grandparents would have had.
And sometimes I think people want to actually understand it. You know, it doesn't mean they're going to go and get a deer like next week and butcher it, but they want to understand how it works in that. And it does, it's all knowledge when you're going shopping, isn't it?
It is. People want that little bit of knowledge. But as well as that, and one of the things that we'll be talking to John McKenna about a little later in the show is experiential tourism. So people want to experience things now. We all have a lot of stuff, and we can't really share photographs of our stuff on Instagram and social media, but we can tell our friends and family about the things that we're doing and the experiences that we're having. And people like to do that. And a butchery course or a baking class are very Instagram or Facebook friendly. And so you get a little bit of knowledge, you get a little bit of a boasting factor as well, and you experience something new. Right, well, we better take a break. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking to Mary Tien from the Truffle Fairy in Thomastown and in Kilkenny. And then... yeah, we'll be talking all about chocolate and Easter. We'll be back just after these. Email us on studio@communityradiokilkennycity.ie.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt and I'm here with Mags Morrissey. Thank you to those who have contacted the show already, and we'll get to some of those comments in just a few minutes. We're here live today, Friday, from 4 to 5, and you can send in questions or comments by text to 086 353 7782, or you can phone us on 776 2777. If you're listening to the repeat of the show on Monday afternoon, please don't text the show, as we won't get to see your message, but you can still email us, kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Now, we're joined on the line by Mary Tien from the Truffle Fairy Shops. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Francis.
Great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
It's a pity, Mary, we don't have you in with us, because I've brought in some chocolate brownie and Mags has brought in some chocolate brownie, and you could have been the judge now to see whose chocolate brownie was the best.
Oh, no.
I know. No. I know where you live, Mary.
I lost the car key for a while there, so I couldn't make it sound. Yeah, we're back.
A busy time.
Unfortunately, I was going to bring in an egg and a hammer, a lovely little wooden hammer, which my husband made, to crack open an egg live on air. But next year, maybe.
Maybe. Maybe you can use the hammer on your husband now for heading off with your car keys. But it's a busy time of the year for you, I'd say, Mary, is it?
Yes. We're full on production with our eggs and bunnies and little chicks, and yeah, we're having great fun. It's an exciting time of year, because we can experiment a little bit more and do something that we're, you know, besides dipping and making bars. So yeah, it's actually really fun decorating the eggs, and we have a huge one in the shop in Kilkenny on Ormond Street, our new shop, and it's 640 mil high. So yeah, it's like a meter height at least. I'd
say. Over 2 feet in height. And yep, for those who don't know, the Truffle Fairy are a chocolate shop and have a hot chocolate cafe out in Chapel Lane in Thomastown. And you've been making chocolate, Mary, yourself for quite a while, haven't you?
Yes. Well, about 13 years now, Truffle Fairy. So that's kind of when I started the Truffle Fairy. But prior to that, I was a chef. So that would be my background, professional cooking. So worked around kitchens all over, well, around the world a little bit and around Ireland. And then started on my own, on the kitchen table, literally. And got interested in chocolate because it was challenging and quite technical. So it interested me. And then sourcing it, because I started out on farmers' markets and I was working alongside very interesting farmers and cheesemakers, and it was kind of important to me to be able to stand over my product. So I really started getting into where I was sourcing my couverture from, what I was using, and that I could stand up and, you know, talk about that to my customers and, you know, make sure that the cacao farmers that I was supporting were being fairly paid above fair trade prices, and, you know, that it was sustainably grown as well, the cacao. And yeah, so that was important to me. So along the line, you know, before it gets to me, you know, as much as we can guarantee that, you know, we're using a product that is ethical and sustainable.
And that, I presume, is still the case then, Mary?
And fine flavour. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And where does the cacao or the chocolate that you use come from?
The couverture which we use is manufactured in Switzerland.
Okay.
But chocolate comes from, it's the Theobroma cacao, is the cacao tree, and it originates in South America.
Mm-hmm.
But has migrated around the world to Western Africa and the Caribbean and Malaysia. And it's basically grown on the thick branches or the bark of the tree, which is quite unusual. And it's a fruit, and it's a pod, so it's a kind of fit in your hand, I suppose. About 8 inches, 10 inches long, nice oval shape. And you get about maybe between 20, 30, 40 beans. It depends on the genotype of the pod. And the cacao bean is the fruit inside, and that's in a really white pulp, and it's harvested twice a year, one main crop and then a secondary crop, and it's always fermented and dried where it's harvested. So that takes about, like, fermentation takes about 4 to 6 days, and that's in the tropics where it's harvested. On, you know, they scoop out mm-hmm. the cacao, the beans out of the pod.
That's a kind
and
of stage
laid on banana leaves to ferment.
That's a stage in the process that a lot of people don't really consider. And it was only when we had Eleanor Duggan in from the Little Greengrocer recently, and she was talking about fermented foods, mm-hmm. A love of hers, and she included chocolate in the fermented food list.
Yes, yeah.
Because of that fermentation process.
It's an essential stage. It has to, you know, the fermentation has to, because it develops the flavour,
mm-hmm.
so it's very important. And then they're spread out onto trays, you know, to dry naturally in the sun, or there's artificial drying now as well in certain places. And that takes up from 1 to 2 weeks. And then, it's only then the beans are ready to be packed into sacks. Hessian sacks for, you know, to be taken, shipped for manufacture, for mm-hmm. chocolate manufacture. So then they arrive in, you know, wherever they're coming to, and there is a few, which is fantastic to see in Ireland now, we have a few bean to bar makers, so we're, you know, and it's there's a growth in that craft chocolate industry, which is lovely, but it's a different thing that what we're doing. Like, we're chocolatiers, so we add flavour to chocolate. So.
And there's no limit, really, to what can be added to the chocolate once somebody like yourself gets their hands on it. Because I see out in the shop huge variation in colour and flavours and little flecks of chilli on some of the chocolates. Really beautiful display that you always have in the shops.
Thank you, yes. I mean, that's the beauty of being a chocolatier. You can really add, well, it's... number one, you start with a really good product. So, like, Falklin is where we source our chocolate from in Switzerland, and there are small manufacturers, and they source really high quality beans. So they process it into chocolate, and it's it's a really fine, high quality, you know, it's and that reflects the price as well that we pay. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to be able to start with a lovely flavour bean. Mm-hmm. And then some of our chocolate bars we mightn't do hardly anything with. They're just nice to be plain. And our Easter eggs, all single origin again, Venezuela, 65% minimum. Beautiful, fruity tones coming through. And you don't have to do much with that, you know. But the truffles then, I mean, it's just lovely. We always enrobe in either a Madagascar 64 or the Venezuelan 65. And it depends on what flavours. Some fruity flavours, like we'd use High Bank Orchard, driver cider and apple syrup, and then mix that with an organic blackcurrant, and it's just wonderful. And that goes really well with Venezuelan 65 because there's fruity tones there. So, and yeah, it's interesting. And each harvest then is different because it depends on the sun and the moisture and the weather determines the whole, the flavours of the beans. So each crop is different. So you're always playing around. You're always tasting. You know, it's like coffee, I suppose, but more complex.
Sure, sure.
You know, and wine, you know, it's like there's actually 800 different flavours if you were to taste chocolate, but none of us would ever be able to taste 800 flavours in one. But, you know, it's really, really, really complex. We don't even realise, you know, and we're learning every day, and that's why it's so exciting to work as a chocolatier.
It's a long way from the bar of milk chocolate in the shop, really, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, the first ingredient there is sugar usually, so, mm-hmm. you know, ours is cocoa mass.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. And cocoa mass is the, you know, the paste produced by the ground down nibs, which we actually sell the nibs as well, and really high quality cacao butter and cacao powder for people that want to make their own, you know, do their own experimenting at home and baking. And
we were talking a little bit earlier on about some courses. Mags is doing a bread course tomorrow. I have a butchery course out of Crowing Cottages. You guys do some classes in the shop as well, do you?
We have done some workshops, children's party workshops. We're kind of limited, I suppose, to the time because we produce Monday to Friday. So it is a plan in the future to kind of that I will be putting on probably workshops,
sure.
or like truffle making workshop, mm-hmm. and then maybe coordinating with the School of Food as well and running courses or classes up there because they have a larger space. But I've, you know, children's parties, we can have, you know, up to 8, and probably minimum age would be 8 as well to get the most benefit from actually doing, like, you know, they can make bars or lollipops and decorate their own and decorate the birthday cake.
God, I can imagine how big a hit
that
would be.
An hour and a half, and that's really good fun. I just need to get the advertising out there.
Well, we'll do our bit to help, Mary. We'll do our bit to help. And the new shop then on Ormond Street in Kilkenny, so it's just around by the Cutting Veg there, up towards the Ormond Hotel, just that little turn at Willoughby's, between Willoughby's and the Hibernian Bar.
That's exactly it, under the car park, right beside Helen, and it's a lovely little spot, and I mean, we do our full range of hot chocolates, the spiced ones and single origin, and you can make your own mix if you like, because we have all our spices there. There's no syrups or anything. It's really, you know, it's whatever you fancy, and lovely coffee as well to go. So, yeah, the next time you want to walk in the Castle Park, head in for your hot chocolate
there.
And yeah. queues.
Ormond Street.
Well, not many queues.
Yeah, Ormond Street is kind of, that little part of Kilkenny actually, developing some nice little artisan foodie kind of shops. So there's yourself, there's Helen in the Cutting Veg next door.
Wonderful vegan food and vegetarian food.
That's right, yeah. And the girls over in Cafe Le Coco do their nice sandwiches as well, just across the road.
Yeah, and Cafe Cat. It's good, yeah. It's a lovely little street now, and we have Lambert up. We all complement each other with the flowers and the chocolates and the, you know, you can get a whole meal and presents and gifts from Kilkenny on Ormond Street.
I'm just thinking, actually, around Mother's Day or somebody's special birthday, you could just take a wander up Ormond Street, get some flowers, some chocolates, grab yourself a hot chocolate as a treat while you're doing the shopping. Yeah, I must bear that in mind, actually, yeah. And then the store, the cafe out in Thomastown as well, is doing well. There's always a few people sitting in the window as I pass out there, and lovely coffees out there too.
Yeah, it's lovely. And the beauty of Thomastown is, besides being a really nice spot and all the other small little interesting businesses that are there, but you get the aroma, you get the smell. I mean, you get the smell in Kilkenny as well of the chocolate, but in Thomastown you get to see it pouring out, you know.
Yeah, it's nice to see it, actually.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the prize for the wheelbarrow, the overall prize last week was a lovely hamper from the Truffle Fairy. It was all little Easter things. Yeah, it was really cool, actually, and very delicate and delicious looking.
Thank you.
So Easter coming up, and you've a range of eggs then in both of the shops in Kilkenny and in Thomastown.
Yes, there's milk, a few white, may get more of those done, but they you know, range from little small filled eggs, you know, so the price range from €4 up to, you know, 30, 37, if you want truffles inside. So, you can order in either of the shops or at the farmer's market next Thursday, and we'll be in Dunleary as well on Sunday at the market up there.
And how much is that giant egg that's in the window then? In total?
Giant, now that sets you back about, I don't expect it to be so bad. About €400.
€100?
No, 400.
€400, oh my God, wow, that would have to be somebody very special.
There's nearly €200 of chocolate in it. So
wow.
That will just tell you, it's a very heavy egg, and it's single origin, and it's real chocolate.
Well, if you want to go...
It melts in the sun.
If you want to go have a look at the giant egg, it's in the window in the Truffle Fairy on Ormond Street in Kilkenny. So go along and have a look before somebody whips it up before the weekend. And at the website then, Mary, truffleferry.ie?
Truffleferry.ie, that's it. And Facebook page, Truffle Fairy. I must put up a few shots.
Get a photograph of that egg up there.
I will.
Great. And we tweeted about the show earlier on, so once we have a podcast of our little chat, I'll put a tweet up about it as well. And maybe you can get a photograph of the egg up on Twitter.
Okay. Thanks a million.
Lovely. Francis. Thanks very much for talking to us, Mary. So that was
Mary
Tien there in the Truffle Fairy in Thomastown and in Kilkenny, on Ormond Street in Kilkenny. And that egg is very impressive, actually. And all the chocolates are very impressive.
They
look lovely.
Yeah.
They really are. And when you go out there for a coffee and grab one of the little chocolates, I'm not a huge chocolate fan, I have to admit. I don't have that massive sweet kind of craving. I prefer my savoury kind of stuff or a bit of pastry. But I always find with a nice coffee, one of the little truffles that you get in the Truffle Fairy is just perfect.
It's just the size is perfect.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely perfect. And it kind of complements the coffee, makes it much more enjoyable.
And she does amazing flavours like cardamom and great mixes. At Christmas, actually, she does a Christmas pudding chocolate, just quite amazing.
Isn't it funny when you're talking to a serious chocolatier like Mary, or you're talking to somebody who's really into their coffee, or you're talking to somebody about wine, a producer or a sommelier, they all start to talk about the scent, the aromas, the terroir, where the beans are from, where the fruit is from. It's the same kind of science, really.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Right, well, we better take another break. And coming up after the break, we'll be talking to John McKenna from the McKenna's Guides and the Bridgestone Guides about his and Sally's new book, The Best of Ireland. We'll be back just after these. Call us now on 056-7762-777.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're welcome back to the Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt and I'm here with Mags Morrissey. We're live here today, Friday from 4 to 5, and you can send in questions or comments by text to 086-353-7782 or on the phone 776-2777. If you're listening to a repeat of the show on Monday afternoon, please don't bother texting us as we won't get to see your message, but you can still email the show at kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And there are some messages in there, Mags, but it's a busy show and we haven't got to any of them yet.
Uh-uh.
And now we're joined on the line by John McKenna. Hi, John.
Hi, Good evening, Francis. How are you?
Thanks very much for joining us on the show, John.
You're very welcome.
Delighted to get to talk to you again. And I have Ireland the Best in front of me, although I keep saying the best of Ireland, but it's Ireland the Best, an insider's guide to Ireland by yourself and the lovely Sally. I have it in front of me. It's quite a heavy book.
Yeah, it was pretty much 13 months flat out. And I suppose with the addition of pretty much 30 years now that Sally and I have been traversing the country looking for, well, the best places to stay, the best places to eat, the best places to drink. What this book gave us the chance to do with Ireland the Best was to add in the history, the culture, the best places to walk, the best beaches to swim, the best historical artifacts. So when we were asked by the publishers of its, if you like, its mothership, which is a book called Scotland the Best, they had an idea, and we got an email through our website last year, and they said, would you fancy writing a book called Ireland the Best? And we thought about it, as you'd say, long and hard for about 2 seconds, and we said, yeah, we would. We really would love to go for it. And 13 months later, we had it kind of wrapped up. It's about 2,000 entries, about 424 pages. And, well, yeah, I hope it's okay.
And it's top to bottom, left to right of the island, really. It covers the whole island.
It's the whole shebang, yeah. I mean, it's from, you know, Malinhead to Cage of Fields to, you know, Kilkenny's historical mile to really every interesting thing we could find, Francis, because, you know, we're living in an age, we're told nowadays, when anybody who's travelling anywhere, really, wants, in terms of modern tourism, an immersive experience, as they say. So we kind of said to ourselves, well, you know, what would we want to know? We'd want to, and what we've been doing for the last 25 odd years is to write about nice places to eat, nice places to stay, nice places to get a drink. But then we sort of said, you know, we're also kayakers. I'm the world's worst kayaker. Sally's not a bad kayaker. And we said, well, hang on a minute. You know, if you were in Donegal, where would you go kayaking? Or if you're in West Cork, or if you were really interested in wildlife, you know, one of the great facts I discovered, for example, we live down here in West Cork, and not too far away in Glengariff, in the beautiful Glengariff woods, there is a particular snail which is really not found in very many places other than in the Glengariff woods, and apparently it's regarded as being a very handsome snail.
Oh.
As snails go.
By other snails or by you?
Well, you would know the answer to that much better than me. So, I mean, I imagine it's the, I don't know, the Brad Pitt or the Angelina Jolie or whatever it might be of the snail world. But we kept coming across these wonderful, extraordinary, unlikely occurrences, so that if you go, you know, I would go into the Glengariff Woods just to have a picnic and to enjoy the particularly up at the lake, up the hill, and but now, you know, you're thinking, well, gosh, careful where you walk, because there's handsome slugs underfoot.
That's gas. And I wonder, at the launch of the book earlier in the week, I know Ava was there from Gaelic Escargot. Did you talk to her about your handsome snails that you have down in Glengariff Woods?
You know, I didn't get the chance to, and of course I didn't want to kind of cause any offence, because, you know, it's like all our children are geniuses and all our dogs are intelligent, and I certainly didn't want to say, actually, Ava, you know, my snails are better looking than yours.
She is very proud of her snails.
You know, I was treading carefully there, as you should.
And I see, actually, that you're walk in Glengariff Woods is described as one of the river walks in the book on page 337.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is what we were trying to do, as to say, I mean, you know, because actually this was for me, one of the interesting things. The book took really 13 months researching and writing, and certainly for the first 6 months, given that I've only been a professional writer for 40 years, to be perfectly honest, I was at sea. Because I suddenly find myself saying, well, I know how to write about a restaurant, I know how to describe if a hotel works, or if a country house is exceptional, or why is that breakfast good, or, you know, that craft beer is better than that craft beer. And I suddenly had to find myself trying to find a language to say, well, actually, do you know, this is what it's like to kayak at midnight when there's bioluminescence in the water, or this is what it's like, you know, to do the Barrow Walk by boat. And initially I found it extremely difficult to try to kind of get a rhythm and to harmonize the entries with the entries, because obviously Ireland the Best is full of good food and drink, but it's all the extras that we wanted to get. And then we had to find this language that was likely the language we use, the style we use to describe our great chefs and our great food artisans. But it took me fully 6 months being completely at sea before I actually felt, you know, I kind of get it now. Or, I mean, maybe people will call into the show and say, well, actually, he didn't get it, you know, it's bloody awful. But hopefully they won't, and hopefully I did get it. But I certainly had 6 months there where I was really looking at the blank screen every day thinking, I don't think I can do this. You know?
Well, I picked up my copy today and I have to admit, I've only had a chance to look through the Kilkenny entries so far. And I'm looking at Inga Reid here, where you're talking about modern Irish jewellery designers. And you talk about her chokers can look like winged seed, ash keys, her brooches like pebbles on the beach, her necklaces remind you of washed up drying seaweed. I think you've nailed it there, John. So.
Well, no, do you think that was me or my wife? I am, as the world's worst dressed man, I am actually very interested in fashion from a technical aspect. You know, I love, for example, with the Galway Tweed Project, the way they've taken the traditional Irish tweed and then applied this kind of Japanese-style asymmetrical cutting. But the whole world, the wonderful world in Ireland of silverware and even to an extent, with some of the things I love was, you know, knife making and the people who make beautiful spoons and baskets. But to be honest, as a real like as somebody who can neither play the guitar nor play the piano and who is only kind of my only relationship with wood is to kind of chop it for the fire, you know. And then I see the people who make these dazzling wooden plates and spoons, and I mean, to me it's like patisserie. You know, patisserie is the one aspect of the culinary arts that to me is like a dark science, because I find it so bewitching that I just, you know, I get these beautiful desserts come out when I'm eating out and I just think, how do you do that? Because I don't know. And it's exactly the same for me when I see somebody hewing a spoon or fashioning a wooden plate or making a pot, you know, a ceramicist, and I'm just like, I'm like a kid at the zoo, really. It's extraordinary to me. And yet, I suppose what fascinates me about it is I think that the mentality of the craft artisan is actually the same as the food artisan. And that was where I was trying to find a kind of common language to say, look, this person may work in silverware, they may work in ceramics, they may work in pottery, but actually, you know, what they're trying to be, I suppose, to go back to the book's title, they're trying to be their best and they're trying to do their best. And that's what's always attracted me to artisans. It's not that they're pushy or anything like that. It's simply that they are always chasing an ideal. Probably themselves, they feel they probably never get there. And I know certainly every book I write, I think, you know, like when I'm writing it, I think, yeah, this is going to be great. And then I get it and I think, good, another bad one.
Your writing,
common to artisans, you know, they are chasing their best.
Yeah, in your writing and in the work of the artisans, so whether it's the Irish food producers that you promote or the restaurants or the places to stay that you visit, or in the craftspeople that you talk about, I think the common element is passion. And we need to celebrate those people who put a bit of passion into what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I many, many years ago, I had to give a speech at a conference, and people at the time were talking about, well, how do you define an artisan food? And they were talking about, oh, you have two employees, or you earn less than, your company earns less than $100,000 a year, or whatever it may be. And I said, you know, that's not what an artisan food is. And I came up with this formulation, which we call the four P's. What defines an artisan food, and I would actually say an artisan object, is a person, a place, a product, and a passion. And if any one of those things is missing, you actually don't have an artisan piece of craft, and you don't have an artisan food. But when you have those, and when you add in the fifth P, which is perseverance, and you could probably add a sixth P, which is penury, but you need those four P's, because that's what makes something unique. That's what makes somebody want to say, I want to go to Kilkenny to see, you know, to eat in the restaurants, to eat in the pubs. And I have to say, Francis, you know, Kilkenny to me is one of the shining stars. I think it's the most beautiful city in the country, and I think it has a wonderful collection of like-minded people. And I may say, you're fortunate here that this goes right back to the 1960s with, you know, with Kilkenny design. So you have had it longer than anybody else. And I really feel with the historical elements and then with the modern elements of craft and food, you know, you've really got it all in Kilkenny. It's so deep and immersive, and you know, we keep trying to say to people, look, don't be racing through Ireland. Go to a place, stay there, dig deep, get stuck into it, really find the elements that actually make it so unique. And Kilkenny has that, has those riches. And hopefully, you know, a book like this will help to persuade people not to be just racing through or just to be heading down for the weekend, but to actually say, you know, we're going to Kilkenny for the week. We're going to explore the valleys. We're going to do the walks. We're going to do the craft trail. And we're really going to do it in depth, because to me, you know, that's what modern travel and tourism is about. It should be about, you know, I've been saying this for a while now, you know, that historically we, in Ireland, we've based whether we had a successful tourism year on counting heads. How many people did we get? If we got more than last year, then this was a better year. And, you know, that, to me, that's rubbish. What you've got to say to people or ask of people is, how deep were you able to get into the culture? Did you find guides to help you really understand the history of Kilkenny, the history of Smithwick, the modern history of the craft beers? Because there's so much riches, you know, and it's, we mustn't count heads. We must count the level of satisfaction and the level of immersion.
Yeah.
And by the same token, how much money people spend. Because
You're right, John. And I think
important.
You've come up with the seventh P right there, because the seventh P is people. We need people to support these artisans. We need people to enjoy their experience as they travel throughout the country, and as they enjoy that kind of experiential tourism that that you talk about, and which a lot of people seem to want now. So they don't want to buy stuff just for the sake of it, or they don't want to just stand in front of a castle. They want to experience what life was like for the people who lived in the castle and all of that kind of stuff. And
yes, I feel really, you know, one thing, because since we finished the book and then I kind of got the first copies, and I was trying to think, well, what does the book do? And I suppose in a sense what the book is trying to do in terms of introducing you to the history is to kind of telescope time, really, to sort of make you think, you know, imagine if you were, you know, down in Muckross Abbey when that yew tree was planted. Just imagine that. Imagine what it was like, if you can, 600 years ago, or, you know, when Strongbow was in Waterford, or up in Cage of Fields 5,000 years ago, or what it was like when, you know, the Kilkenny Design Centre was set up. What a radical step that was at a fairly bleak time for crafts and for arts in Ireland. I mean, that was one of the most radical artistic steps, I feel, of the 20th century.
And I don't think
enough people celebrate it, really.
Exactly, and we're reaping the benefits of it still. And
this day,
And hopefully a lot of the places throughout the country where we're celebrating the artisan food stuff now, maybe we'll see the benefits of that in years to come, too.
Well, I think we will, you know, because, I mean, just to go back to what we were saying there about, you know, the person who creates a product in a particular place, you know, the objective really needs to be to, if a visitor arrives, you know, and they enjoy it and they spend some money, is that money needs to stay in the location. That's how you build a successful city, a food culture, a craft culture, a culture, if you like, because, you know, restaurants need money, but craftspeople need money.
Yes.
Pubs need money. Good hotels need money. They don't need to earn gazillions, but they do need to make a living.
Yes.
And hopefully, you know, what people understand in the country, I have a feeling in Dublin they may have forgotten this, is the objective is not to make a killing. The objective is to make a living. To make, you know, as Norman Steele of Malines Cheese, who created the first artisan cheese with his wife Veronica down in Barry's, on the Beara Peninsula, by the way, in Aries, on the Beara, sorry. As he said to me, you know, the important thing is to make a living making something that matters. And I feel this is what our artisans do. And when I'm writing about them, when I see what they do, it's so inspiring because of their modesty and their humility and their lack of pretension. And here they are crafting beautiful things for us to enjoy. And, you know, it was a great discovery for myself and Sally doing the book to realize that, you know, it's so easy just to go into a shop and buy whatever it is that comes from wherever. But how much nicer it is and how much more meaningful it is to go into a shop and buy something locally produced, whether it's a turnip or it's a piece of ceramics. It doesn't actually matter if you've got an Andrew Luddick extraordinary piece of ceramics or you've got, you know, a beautiful cake from Cake Face. The fact that it's made by local people in that zone, it gives so much more richness, both to the taste of the cake, and to the enjoyment for all those years to come of looking at Andy's piece and saying, my goodness, I mean, like, how does Andrew Luddock's piece, how does he do it? I mean, again, Andrew to me is like one of these guys practicing the dark arts. I just say, how does he do that? I have no idea, but I'm just glad he does.
There's him and plenty of other people artisans for people to discover and enjoy, listed in Ireland the Best, The Insider's Guide to Ireland by John and Sally McKenna. And John, thanks a million for speaking so passionately today.
Thank you so much, Francis. It's a pleasure.
Great. And I look forward to exploring other counties through the book, not just Kilkenny. Thanks again, John.
Fantastic. Hopefully it's all there for you.
Good, man. Thank you. And I really do recommend the book. It's available here in the Book Centre in Kilkenny. The list price is £20.15, but actually the Book Centre have it on a special value, £17.99 at the moment. And it's well worth picking up. A kind of an old-fashioned guidebook.
Proper guidebook, yes.
Yeah, with lots and lots of listings in it. And what I love is, if you're in Donegal, or if you're in Dublin, you might like, or the best places to visit are, or the best places to stay are. So it's a super book, and I thoroughly recommend. Now, we're running way over time, Mags, and just a couple of jobs to kind of do in the garden this week, if you're able to get your spuds in. But bear in mind that this Tuesday evening, 8 o'clock in the Parade Tower, one of Shirley Lanigan's Garden Talk series kicks off, and the first talk this week is by Agnes Aylward, and it's the story of the Locadio Hearn Garden in Waterford. Talks are always absolutely lovely and well worth going along to, and of course they're completely free from 8 in the Parade Tower in the castle. And another couple of jobs then to do, so maybe just get out and have a look at things.